This episode of Therapist Connect podcast is sponsored by WebHealer, the number one website provider for private practice therapists. Serving the community for 20 years, WebHealer offers a non-technical and fully supported online platform helping therapists use the internet to grow their practice. Whether you need a website, a booking system, or even a secure email address for your practice, WebHealer can help. Contact WebHealer today via www.webhealer.net and use the coupon Therapist Connect for £100 off their Do It For Me service.
Welcome to the Therapist Connect podcast, a podcast for therapists by therapists.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Therapist Connect podcast. My name's Dr. Peter Blundell, and today I'm back interviewing therapists about their life and work within the therapy community. Today's guest is Amy Alexander. Amy is a psychotherapist who works in Northamptonshire. She works both face-to-face and online. Her framework for working is relational and trauma-informed, and she has a specific interest in anxiety, eating disorders, and childhood trauma. Amy's website is www.amyalexander.co.uk, or you can also find her on Twitter, which is where we met, at the Twitter handle at Amy Breeds. I'm delighted to welcome her to the podcast today and hear a little bit more about her life and work.
It's lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you too. I'm excited.
Yeah, it's going to be really good. So it'd be really interesting because I don't know a lot about you. So these questions will be kind of... I will get to know a bit more about you.
I was so curious when you messaged me because I felt like, okay, sure. Because we had never really exchanged any messages. I mean, I've liked a lot of your tweets, or, you know, I do a lot of retweeting of Therapist Connect because it's a big audience. But I was really flattered. So I'm really happy to be here. I hope I bring something interesting.
Well, it's great because, as you say, we hadn't really interacted that much, but I heard you in the listening space, which I didn't contribute to. Obviously, I wasn't kind of speaking in that, but I was listening to it. And it was just, I just loved your way in that space, considering that you didn't really know anybody. Yeah. You just kind of joined this space and started speaking to people or other therapists. It was great. So I just thought, yeah, it'd be interesting to hear a bit more about you and your practice.
Well,
I'm sure our listeners will be interested as well.
Very privileged. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So I'm really interested to hear the answer to this question because I've seen a little bit on your website, kind of a little bit about you and you've moved and things like that. So I'm really kind of interested in what drew you to therapy as a profession, kind of what started off your interest as being a therapist?
It is an interesting question because it's complex. I didn't wake up as a, I didn't have a sort of vocational, if you like, calling, which I think a lot of people do in psychotherapy at a young age. I grew up in California, and as you can imagine, in the 70s, I was born in the very early 70s, 71. It was de rigueur to have a therapist. You know, my biological father is a musician, and my mother's a teacher, but she lived in the famous Haight-Ashbury in the 60s. She hung out with the Grateful Dead. My biological father was a very famous musician in the States. So we were always around artists and painters and musicians and poets. And so talking about creativity and talking about your feelings really was not something that was taboo at all. We just kind of accepted that, you know, when people would say, oh, I have a therapist, I'm Rolfing, or I'm, you know, studying Steiner, or these things were very normal to us. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that's the right word, but sadly, unfortunately, my biological father in his musicianship was also an incredibly chaotic person, and wasn't really able to manage his need to be on stage and his need and our need for a father. So my mother, who was very young, I think when I was born, she was 26 or 27. My sister, she was 23. And I come from like a mixed family. So I don't have any full siblings. But my sister and my brother were brought to the family. So it was the five of us, and he was away a lot. And another unfortunate thing is what we suspect now is that my half-brother was born with fetal alcohol syndrome, not my biological mother's son. So life was incredibly chaotic, and he was put into a therapeutic nursery school. So he went to a school called Julianne Singer in Los Angeles, which is basically a therapeutic nursery school. So our language around therapy and our language around mental health was just always in the lexicon of the family. So although that language was there, I wasn't really drawn to being a therapist. I just was familiar with all the conversation around why people go to therapy or what it's for, medication, you know, things like that. As my brother grew older, he became very, very violent and he had an oppositional defiant disorder and, you know, all those things, you know, all those disorders, all the things, suspected possibly even to be schizophrenic, but, you know, so the family had to go into periods of family therapy. And whilst I don't think my therapist was stellar, I think it gave me a language around my own experience. And then as I grew sort of into my teens, I decided to drop out of school. I dropped out of high school when I was 15 or 16 and was very bohemian for a while in Los Angeles. And my parents had divorced by this time, and that was just me and my mother. And I decided at 17 or 18 to move to Arizona randomly with a boyfriend, of course, who was much too old for me. So I sort of ran away. And I worked in care homes with young adults. It was a well-paid job, but easily gotten because they're difficult jobs. So I did that for a while. And then about my 19th or 20th birthday, my biological father called me and said, your brother has taken his own life. He killed himself. And you need to come to Texas, where they were living, and we need to deal with that. So he really, unfortunately, you know, he was such a big shaper of my brother and my father, two incredibly, in my opinion, toxic people, were such a big shaper in my understanding of mirrors and relationships and stories. So when that whole thing happened, I didn't cope at all. And between that and what I know now is post-traumatic stress from a very difficult childhood. I had a breakdown. I hate that word breakdown because I don't think I broke down. I think I broke apart. And my biological father was living in Texas in this tiny little streamlined trailer. And he said, you can come live with me. I mean, I was, you know, I had my hair on fire. He had never offered me solace or space or any of those things. And I was thinking, yes, you know, this is it. This is our time to, you know, do the thing together, to be together. And, you know, hope springs eternal. And he said, I had disclosed to him that my brother had been abusive towards me. And he was, you know, unable to really manage it, but said, I met somebody who is a therapist and she specializes in these things. Do you want to go see her? And I thought, yes, finally, some solace, some relief. It's been so chaotic. It's so difficult. And I went to see her and she really gave me space. And she was a sociology professor or teacher, not a professor. That's not true. She was a sociology teacher, lecturer at the university I went to. And, you know, it was like walking into the softest place. But a lot of my story starts that way. You know, you think it's going to be okay. But I saw her probably for like 8 sessions or 9 sessions. And on the 9th session, having, you know, having her referred me to a psychiatrist, and all these good things were happening. I entered into university. I got my high school diploma, and so things were starting to feel like they were changing. And I got into the session, and she said, "I'm not going to be able to see you anymore because I've gotten out a full-time job at the university." And of course, I was crushed. And she said, "And I'm dating your father." Yeah. So they had started a relationship behind my back. But you have to remember that what's really important in this story is I was very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And although my mother and I now, my mother is, you know, my mother's in her 70s. We have come so far. She is a stellar human being. We have healed so many things. But it was difficult, because my father had fractured so many things, including her, that she really couldn't manage after about 14 or 15 to really hold me together. So if you can imagine somebody who is broken apart and their therapist says, "I'm now going to be your mom." Of course, I was delighted. So that, I thought, right, I'm going to be a sociologist and I'm going to be a therapist, and this is the way it's going to go. And of course, it didn't go that way for a while. And things were good in terms of the illusion of it all. I'm going to take care of your father. He's going to be more present. You know, we're all going to be this fantastic family. She's, you know, meanwhile, she's not even that much older than I am. You know, she's probably 30 and I'm 20 at that point. So, you know, I don't know. It was a shit show, I think, if I can put it that way. But I didn't see that, because everything in me wanted to have space. And that word keeps coming up because it's so important in my own practice, giving people space. So I met somebody when I was at university, and I was now living on my own, but, you know, going to dinner and, you know, all these things. Didn't think anything was wrong here, because I didn't want to see anything being wrong. And I met my former husband, who's British, and I fell in love with him. And I was like in my early 20s, and he said, "Come on, visit." And so I ran as fast as I could. My instinct said, "Run. This is not a good place for you." So I ran. And I came to England, and we got married, and I had a little boy who's no longer so little. In 1996, I had my son, Max. And, you know, things were good, and then things were bad. Because, of course, I chose somebody who couldn't manage to be available to me. But I also know I was jobless, and I really was drawn to this idea of, it kept coming back to me, "Why don't you just investigate it? Just investigate it." So I did. And I went to Hackney Community College, I think it was called then. And I did a certificate in counseling, and I was a single mom. So I was working at Rank Xerox, as it was then, doing IT rollouts, which was really boring. And I started to really thrive in that area. So it just, at that point, I thought, right, I'm going to do the next thing. And then I'm going to do the next thing. So I got to the point where I was doing sort of intermediate. And then I went to my level, which now is a level 7, but then was a level 5 in the 90s, late 90s. And of course, I had to start seeing a therapist. So I met what was, I can believe, probably the love of my life. She's the greatest. We're no longer working together because she's retired, but she really did offer space. And when I told her the story about becoming a therapist, and when I told her the story that I told you and what your face sort of fell, same thing happened with her. And it, again, cracked some more things open, where I realized that that relationship was probably one of the most damaging things that had ever happened to me, was my therapist being in a relationship with my father. And I started to realize that this work was going to be my life's work, was to create space for myself and for other people to feel truly safe, to feel truly heard, to feel truly welcomed into a place of curiosity and creativity and boundaries and loving boundaries and also love. You know, to say this place is a loving place. This is not a scary place where someone's going to get you. So as my career grew and as I, you know, got into to more training, that, you know, I was, again, a single parent. So it was a big juggle, but I created this fantastic practice, which nearly 25 years later, because Max is 26. So that's how I got into psychotherapy.
Wow.
No.
I mean, thank you so much for sharing so much of your experience there, but I was just thinking about, it sounds like that there was so many different aspects that kind of came together.
There were.
For you to get to that point to be a therapist, but also what's really standing out to me is that kind of idea of wanting to create safe spaces for other people and based on actually being in some very unsafe spaces yourself over different periods of time.
But also being able to manage that in some way with my first psychotherapist, my first very impactful psychotherapist, who was a transactional analyst. And she just made it okay. And I don't mean she fixed it. I don't mean, you know, although she'd helped me fix it. She made it okay to be curious, to be angry, which is something I'd never really done, is got angry, because angry always meant violence in my home. So you don't pick this stuff up, you get hit. You know, or, you know, you're sent to your room, or women in my experience were just very vulnerable creatures who couldn't step between me and the world. So creating that space, not only did my first therapist create that space for me, I was able to create that space for me. I started to think about myself in very different ways with my studying and also being a single parent of a boy. And creating a community in England, in London. I lived in London almost his whole life and now live in the countryside. So creating those spaces, they just kept being created. Some of them were very negative and very hurtful, and some of them were explosively beautiful, and some of them were terribly ordinary, just ordinary stuff. Because my expectations were the ordinary was extraordinary. And actually, I was creating ordinary safe spaces that weren't extraordinary. They were just a given.
Thank you for sharing that. So you did qualify to become a therapist.
I did. I actually started practicing in 1999, and I qualified because I had to do all my hours. Yeah. I worked at Victim Support, which is one of the funniest and one of the most wonderful experiences of my life. Because it was real maverick it was a real maverick entity back then. So I got all my hours and then I started my practice.
Can you tell me what you mean by maverick?
Listen, I worked at Victim Support in Wood Green in London, North London. And if you know, you know. And these two women ran Victim Support. They ran it with everything in their body. You know, there was no... But it was like they would go outside and smoke, you know, and they would cackle, and they would, you know, they were just these two extraordinary, tough inner city London women. And they sort of did what they felt like they needed to do to help people who were victimized by crime. And it was maverick. And I think a lot of the women in my life are pretty maverick. But I love.
Are you a maverick?
My maverick. I think in my own way, I certainly am within my own self. You know, I think that what makes me maverick is that I didn't die. And I know that sounds extreme, but my life was extreme as a child, that I said yes to not dying. But it doesn't mean I said yes to life. I just said yes to not dying, which is a huge achievement. Coming from where certainly my sister and I came from, and from my mother, and to break that generational trauma was a hard work miracle. So that's the maverick that I see in myself. Yeah.
And so you did break that generational trauma. And you became a therapist.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your career then as a therapist?
Sure.
Where is it taking you?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that has always been difficult for me is to be seen. Now, I say that, and, you know, I'm sure my mother, when she listens to this, will laugh because they used to call me the bold one as a little child. I used to be, and have a lot of regulation or filters. And I was always the one who was like, let's do a play. My mother said that when I was 4 years old, one of the friends was coming over and he was an orphan and he was also tremendously overweight, two things he was incredibly sensitive about. And I was only four, so my parents weren't going to say, don't say anything. But my mom said, you know, you opened the door and said, hi, my name's Amy. Why are you so fat? And where's your mama? So I was really just locked in, you know. So being seen is different from being observed, and being seen is different from being an emotional puffer fish, which I was my whole life. So with my career, I started to quiet down, and I did this level. I did this level five. It was like a BTEC at that CPA, you know, it's that sort of at that level. But it was, you know, I did it for 2 years and I worked hard and I worked through it and I earned every minute of it I earned. But then I thought, right, so what am I going to do with this? I mean, I can see clients, but what's my hook, as they say? And I had had a very substantial eating disorder as a young woman. And I thought, right, I wonder, is there any eating disorders therapists in 1999? None. So little. So I went to the National Center for Eating Disorders, run by Deanne Jade. And I did a master's practitioner, you know, whatever, you know, that's worth. It's worth a lot for a lot of people. And certainly it started my career. So I will be forever grateful to them. I know there's some controversy around them, but they helped me start my career. So I will always be grateful. And I just started to, in my, I guess, maverick way, take clients who were dreadfully ill with eating disorders. And that's where it started. And then I started to work with a colleague who she said she wanted to start an eating problem service, not like the National Center for Eating Disorders. I don't know if you remember. It was that before BEAT. So we started that. Well, she started. I was a founding member. And then that went on to starting a charity called Foundations. And Foundations was a charity that was aimed at going to schools and doing workshops with young girls, not boys, because, of course, at that time, we weren't being inclusive. We didn't see that boys had eating disorders. Or if we did, it didn't really come into it. We weren't there yet. So we taught and we did all that. But, you know, as always, as it always is, unpaid. So working for charities and being, as you said, a maverick in those situations is great, but I had a child to feed and it was taking up all of my time. So I decided to pull back from those things and just work more in my practice. So I did that for many, many years. I worked really exclusively with eating disorders.
This is just a short break to have a message from one of our sponsors, so please don't go anywhere. If you'd like to sponsor an episode of the Therapist Connect podcast, send us an email for more details, info@therapist-connect.com.
This episode of Therapist Connect podcast is sponsored by WebHealer, the number one website provider for private practice therapists. Serving the community for 20 years, WebHealer offers a non-technical and fully supported online platform helping therapists use the internet to grow their practice. Whether you need a website, a booking system, or even a secure email address for your practice, WebHealer can help. Contact WebHealer today via www.webhealer.net and use the coupon Therapist Connect for £100 off their Do It For Me service.
We hope you enjoy the rest of this episode.
And then, I decided to go master's in psychotherapy. Oh, and I had an interview, and the director of the transactional analysis program said, you don't need to do the first year. You're 15 years in or 16, no, 17, 16 years in. I'm going to grandparent you into the program. And I thought, right, okay, here we go. And it was miserable. I hated it. Absolutely hated it. Because I had been working on my own for so many years. And I was sitting in a group of people who had not been psychotherapists. So the language I was using was seen as elitist and difficult. And my supervisor talks about that time and that group as a narcissistic group. It was probably one of the hardest experiences of education I've ever had. And I am dyslexic in some ways and a little bit ADD. So it was hard for me at any rate. Plus, my formal education was nout. It was a really hard experience, and I felt very bullied. Very, very bullied. And so I didn't finish. I couldn't do it. With all the other things that were going on, I did my second and third year. And then I decided that at that time in my life, things were really kind of personally quite good. So I didn't follow through with it. I decided for my own mental health that I wasn't going to do it. But I did gain from the hours and hours and the essays and the nose to the grindstone and experiencing that group process, which was brutal. And I'm sure some of people will understand that group process. Brutal. I think what it did for me was it allowed me in group process to swim with the alligators. And I wouldn't like to call anybody individually alligators because that's not true. But the process was wild. It was a wild process. So it taught me how to experience education and learning and group process. And it really changed my life. So I'm, again, forever grateful because it changed transactional analysis and those theoretical frameworks and talking and exploring. It changed my ability to, it just changed everything. So from that, I just started to see my practice differently. Completely differently. And I became a very different kind of therapist.
So there's still valuable learning that came
so
from that.
So valuable.
Although the experience of it sounded quite traumatic, really, to go through.
Well, you know, look, I think that I was underprepared and didn't know how to defend myself. Because I think, you know, when people talk about an adapted child, I couldn't do very much in the face of it except for go home and, you know, cry, which was fine. But it was an invaluable experience, and I wouldn't change it because, you know, sandpaper, you know, brings things smooth. Am I like resentful? Am I ain't? Not at all. I don't have those people on my Facebook. I'll tell you that for free. Friend press, no. But I do carry them with me as light bearers to my learning. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's sort of been my career, and working alone is tough. Working on your own is tough. And I burnt out in 2017. I burnt out completely burnt out. I was like, why am I doing this? What is therapy for? This is a stupid job. And I really would think that, why am I coming to this off? Who do I think I am? It was kind of an existential, why am I here? Who do I think I am? This is a bullshit profession. with mean people. I don't want to do it anymore. Of course, I do.
Yeah.
But it was a tough time.
But a real crisis of confidence in it in that moment.
And it's the being seen again. It's, you know, I find that being seen, and whether that be with success can, or openness, or saying, hey, these are my qualifications, this is what I know how to do, can be very intimidating. And so being a private practice can be a way of hiding from that. I mean, you don't get a cake on your birthday, and I've got, you know, two dogs, two fish, and a cat who greet me at the office door. So no one's saying, how was your weekend? They're just looking at me to get fed. So it's tough, but you can certainly not make very much noise and hide behind a lot of stuff.
And there is something about that, something we know about in Therapist Connect. There's so many practitioners out there who do feel extremely lonely and isolated and seen in private practice.
Actually. And you know what helped with that? And I know this is, I have a private Twitter, you know, but it was so, I had to stop. It was just too many. It was bad. I didn't like the stuff I was reading. It didn't pertain to me. It seemed like everyone was just shouting into, you know, the blackest of nights. So I'm not doing that anymore. And then I thought, actually, I'll just have a professional Twitter. And I thought, oh, hi, everybody. And that really allowed me to see a lot more people. And though I've only been on Twitter for like, I don't know, 6 months, it really did start a conversation in my own mind about knowing things.
And it's interesting because that's how what happened with me originally.
Right.
I had a personal account and was like, what is this? I don't understand what is going on here.
Why is everyone so mad? So many mean people, stop.
And now I have a professional account. I understand why everyone's mad there.
Right. That is interesting. And, you know, I don't know. I don't tweet a lot, and I do a lot of tweeting that's just real gentle because it's how I feel like I want to be in the world. I can't, you know, it's like, it's not my circus. It's not my monkeys. I have so many other things, and I have fought for the 51 years on this earth for a lot of causes. Personal and not professional, I have to be honest with you, but first, and I can't, and those fights are they're too much for me. I don't have the room anymore. I think about them though, but I know when to hold them and when to fold them. And I, you know, it's important to keep yourself safe because that's can consume you, that stuff.
Yeah. And I really appreciate a lot of the people who have those fights, but it's that balance for me as well, in terms of like, what am I practically doing, and then what am I just kind of tweeting about? and sometimes I'm like, actually I need to go and invest my energy and go into practically doing something about this.
Yes. And you know, I also think, I mean, if we're talking a little bit about social media and Twitter, I am very much enjoy, I really find great joy in being friends with on Twitter. Is that what you call it? Friends with on Twitter? People who are advocating for themselves and are saying, don't say that about me, or don't do that. It gives me great joy. And also people who are using words that I've never heard of, these incredible PhD, you know, professors of neuropsychology. So I'm taking what I need from those incredible people.
I mean, as a space and a place for knowledge and insight into other people's experiences, it's such a resource. Thinking about the broader therapy community then, what do you think is like the biggest challenge that we might face as a profession right now?
Diversity. Mm-hmm. Diversity, diversity, diversity. I think we have to be able to afford people who come from places of disadvantage the opportunity to be curious about their process and the process of others. And if we are charging 6,000 pounds and for education for a year, whatever it is, or 8 or 10, and we are asking people to then work their hours for free to get their hours, tell me this is not privilege on fire. We have to change this. It's a bad idea.
We touched on this a little bit because we spoke about social media, but I'm wondering, and I suppose you touched on it in other ways as well, but I wondered how connected do you feel to the wider therapy community? Has that shifted at all over the time that you've been?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I also am really lucky to, I have wonderful friends and family, so I have those kinds of things, but I'm not as connected to my therapy community and the men and women and other that I would like to be. And I don't quite know why that is. Maybe I'm a little hesitant because it's like, what is a group of therapists? In my experience, it's like a murder of therapists. So I'm gently walking into a place of being seen and seeing others. I think it's a gentle process.
Well, that's, I mean, I find that fascinating because of where we met. Well, actually, no, I met you there. You didn't necessarily meet me there. I was in the Twitter, is it called the listening space? I'm not sure what it's called.
A
Twitter room. Which was different therapists, or someone had set up the room just to talk about kind of therapy and
the therapy. Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, and then you were in there with kind of like, I think like six other people kind of just from all over the world just talking about like what it's like to be a therapist.
A lot about what it's like to be therapist in our regions, and there were some people who were really worried that our clients were listening, and I remember saying, but I'm not saying anything that's going to hurt. Take those risks and hurt anybody. That would be beyond my ethical place to go. So this is a creative space, and we're all just talking about each other and to each other.
Yeah. But I'm interested in that, in that you don't necessarily feel that connected. What drove you or pushed you to kind of speak in that space? Do you know what it was at the time that?
When people started talking about that whole thing that went around on Twitter about, do you eat with your clients?
Yes. Yeah.
And I was pretty sure it's one of the first things that I said. I guess I virtually raised my hand and I said, you know, I find this fascinating that we're asking each other these questions, because what it really feels to me like is we're avoiding the fact that many therapists at the moment are in the dumpster fire with our clients in the existential angst of war, famine, climate change, COVID. And it's kind of easier for us, I certainly believe this, to talk about those inane things, which are inane in my opinion, because you do what's best for your practice. I trust you if you're working with clients. 9 times out of 10, I think in this country, I trust you. Then we're avoiding something that's incredibly difficult. So what are we avoiding? And by asking these questions.
I think it's something really important in that, in terms of like, where is our focus, you know, like kind of what are we actually focusing our attention on? And, you know, sometimes there is light relief, I suppose.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
We get that. But it was quite interesting to see the escalation.
It really did escalate as well. It really escalated. But also, doesn't that really bring us to a point where we are all so on the edge of something? You know, and I can see that in my practice. I can see it with myself. I can see it, you know, and because I have learned so much about, you know, trauma and complex trauma in my own work and in my practice, it feels to me like we've all been pretty traumatized by the last couple of years in whatever shape or form that is. And so we're sort of on the edge. So what are you eating a march for becomes, you know, like a thing.
I wondered whether the escalation possibly was also like what you're saying, but also connect to almost like every single therapist could have an opinion on that topic. You know, not all topics are not necessarily, or some therapists might feel, oh, I don't know if I can enter into this discussion. Whereas that was a topic where each therapist could say, I have an opinion on that and what I do.
Yeah, but isn't that something about Twitter? Isn't that something about all of us? We all want to have an opinion. And I certainly know that a part of being on Twitter, if you're working in private practices, you can have an opinion. Yeah. And that was, but it did strike me as, and this is one of the, when I say there, you know, there are things I will put my feet into and things I will take my feet away from, those kinds of fires. I mean, it's hard because I want to, sometimes I, you know, I go to the keyboard and I think, well, hold on one second. Is this adding any value? And if I can't add value, I'm not saying it. And that's not from a place of at all, like, if I'm not giving my best person, no, if I can't add value to this, if I don't feel this is valuable, I don't think I'm going to say it.
I really appreciate that. I think it's such a difficult thing to do.
So hard.
With Twitter in the moment, or will I leave it? Will I come back to this? You know, I think it's really, really, really difficult.
My beloved therapist, when I first started back into therapy years ago, said to me something that's always stuck to me. And she said, not everything needs to be said. Mm. Not everything needs to be said.
And maybe we could add to that, not everything needs to be said on Twitter.
Well, I think that's a good amen. That's an amen. Yes, I agree.
Oh dear. Oh, Amy, it's been lovely. I suppose my last question would be kind of, what are you kind of up to next? Like, have you got any plans for the future, or
I do. I think I'm going to very much carry on working with complex post-traumatic stress. It's really, for me, it's a connection. It's body work in myself and in others. I really believe that trauma and complex post-traumatic stress has so much to do with illness and so much to do with addiction and behavior. And although I am firmly on the side of psychiatry, and I know that's uncomfortable for some people, but the pills do work for so many people. So I think a mixture of making sure in a holistic way that my practice continues on supporting not only me and giving things to me, but to my clients, because really it's about, my practice is really has been about growing me up. I really grew up as a human being and as a woman. I grew up in my practice, and my clients have grown up with me. Some of my clients I've had for, you know, a decade. So we've grown up with each other. So I think what I see in the next 20 years is more growing. Eventually, I would like to get back into teaching. A little bit. I'd like to teach. And I'd like to start a podcast. But I don't know of what yet. And I don't know how that's going to be. But I've been encouraged a lot recently. So I think I'm going to try that outfit on and see what happens. That and just, you know, having as much good fun as I can.
Brilliant. That sounds fantastic. And any tips for the podcast, just ask us and we'll...
I will.
We've been through the mill, so we know all the bits.
I will. I will be asking you. I will. And I so appreciate the space to talk about my career, which is something I don't often do. Because when people ask me what I do for a living at dinner parties, I say, oh, psychotherapist. And they say, I bet you know what I'm thinking. And I say, if you looked at my fees, I might be able to tell you. But until then, you have to pay me a substantial amount of money in order for me to tell you what you're thinking. So it's good to talk.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. And I've really enjoyed it. It's so nice to kind of hear about you and your experience. And let's stay connected.
I would love that. Thank you so, so much.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you for listening to the Therapist Connect podcast. Go to www.therapist-connect.com for more discussions and debates.
This episode of Therapist Connect podcast is sponsored by Webhealer, the number one website provider for private practice therapists. Serving the community for 20 years, Webhealer offers a non-technical and fully supported online platform helping therapists use the internet to grow their practice. Whether you need a website, a booking system, or even a secure email address for your practice, Webhealer can help. Contact Webhealer today via www.webhealer.net and use the coupon Therapist Connect for £100 off their Do It For Me service.